Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something that can help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, wisdom, and temperance. And here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers, we reflect, we prepare, we think deeply about the challenging issues of our time, and we work through this philosophy in a way that's more possible here when we're not rushing to work or to get the kids to school, when we have the time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with our journals, and to prepare for what the future will bring. I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text Daily Stoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text Daily Stoic to 500-500. There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80. Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. I've got a fascinating guest this week, someone I've wanted to talk to since I first saw some of his videos. I'm talking about Congressman Dan Crenshaw. I was introduced to Congressman Crenshaw through another guest we've had on the podcast and another congressman, Congressman Mike Gallagher. Dan is a fascinating guy. He's a former Navy SEAL. He did 5 tours of duty with the Navy SEALs, you know, a real American hero. He lost his right eye in 2012 in an IED explosion. He's been awarded 2 Bronze Stars, the Purple Heart, and Marine Corps Commendation Medal, achieved the rank of Lieutenant Commander in the Navy. And then in 2018, he won an election for the United States House of Representatives in Texas's 2nd Congressional District, which is not far from me in Texas. I first heard of Dan, like a lot of people, when he was made fun of by Pete Davidson on Saturday Night Live. I was telling you about his IED explosion. So Dan wears an eye patch. And so he was teased on television. And while it would have been probably an easy way to score political points, to be outraged, to be offended, Dan reacted with good humor and grace. He ended up going on SNL and joking about it. This sort of catapulted him to the national stage, to be sure. But he's had some awesome appearances on Joe Rogan's podcast. A couple weeks ago, he did an amazing appearance on Bill Maher, where he sort of presented what was a pretty compelling counter-narrative to the idea that Donald Trump has bungled the response to the coronavirus pandemic. Dan's really smart. He's got a graduate degree from Harvard,
you know, he knows his stuff. I don't agree with him on everything, but he knows his stuff and he's smart. And I think it is important that we have conversations with people we disagree with, people who are smart, who can challenge our viewpoints. And that's really the premise of Dan's newest book, which I read and really enjoyed. It's called Fortitude: American Resilience in the Era of Outrage. It's a great book. You know, obviously fortitude and endurance and strength is a really important idea in Stoic philosophy. He talks about Epictetus in the book. You know, a lot of these sort of political memoirs are just sort of like, you know, they're done by ghostwriters. They're not really sincere. It's just, it's a campaign device. You know, this book is not that. It's a good book. It's an important book. It deserves to be read. Again, don't agree with all of it. I think, as I talk about with Dan, you know, the idea that a sort of lack of fortitude, that this victim culture, snowflake culture exists solely on the left is, you know, preposterous. We've talked about this before. But we live in a culture where people are afraid of, as General Mattis would say, the dangerous world of ideas. They want to retreat into the safety of their own views, their own partisanship, you know, their own convenient, clean narratives. But reality is history is messy. The world is complicated. We're all trying to do the best we can within it. And that becomes really hard when people say certain things are off limits. Instead of engaging with ideas, we label the other side as evil or racist or stupid or, you know, malicious or whatever it is that we're doing. And so we have to talk about these things. And it's actually in the conflict between these ideas that I think we get closer to the approximation of the truth. So it's a great conversation. Dan is a fascinating guy. I think you'll like this. Check out the book, Fortitude. Fortitude is clearly a virtue. It's something we all need more than ever. And as I would say, just as I've said in past episodes to people who were mad that I've criticized, you know, the president or criticized Republicans, if that offends you, the problem is with you, as Epictetus would say. But conversely, people who are upset that, you know, I'm talking to Congressman Crenshaw about some of these ideas, that we're getting into it, that this wasn't a sort of a gotcha thing where, you know, I'm trying to get him to admit this, or I'm trying to argue with him on this, or try to make him look stupid. If you're offended that that didn't happen, again, that problem is with you. So enjoy the interview. It's great stuff, and hope to bring you more guests soon. You know, Dan talks about Epictetus in the book. There is this great overlap between Stoicism and military culture, particularly in the Navy, where Admiral Stockdale is from. Dan talks about that in the interview. He talks about how that's how he came to Epictetus. And actually, he didn't know how to pronounce it because he just sort of read about it. But I think that's fine. I mean, I think there's all these different ways that Stoicism is being spread. And then Dan is, in turn, paying the favor forward by talking about it in his book to all sorts of people who may not have ordinarily heard about it. And so Dan's great. We'll get into it, and I'll talk to you soon. As a bit of a twist today, I thought I would read one of my favorite letters from Seneca. This is letter 12 from the Penguin Classics translation of Seneca's Letters from a Stoic. He writes, "Wherever I turn, I see fresh evidence of my old age. I visited my place out of Rome recently and was grumbling about the expense of maintaining the building, which was in a dilapidated state. My manager told me that the trouble wasn't due to any neglect on his part. He was doing his utmost, but the house was old. The house had taken shape under my own hands, and what's to become of me if stones of my own age are crumbling like that? Losing my temper, I seized at the first excuse that presented itself for venting my irritation on him. It's quite clear, I said, that these plain trees are being neglected. There's no foliage on them. Look at those knotty, dried-up branches and those wretched, flaking trunks. That wouldn't happen if someone dug round them and watered them. He swore by my guardian angel that he was doing his utmost. In everything, his care was unremitting. But the poor things were just old. Between you and me now, I had planted them myself and seen the first leaf appearing on them myself. And then turning towards the front door, I said, 'Who's that? Who's that decrepit old person? The door is the proper place for him, all right. He looks like he's on his way out. Where did you get him from? What was the attraction in taking over someone else's dead for burial?' Whereupon the man said, 'Don't you recognize me? I'm Felicio. You used to bring me toy figures.' 'The man's absolutely crazy,' I said. 'Become a little child again, he has. Actually calls himself my playmate. Well, the way he's losing teeth at this very moment, it's perfectly possible. So I owe it to this place of mine near that my old age was made clear to me at every turn. Well, we should cherish old age and enjoy it. It was full of pleasures if you know how to use it. Fruit tastes most delicious just when its season is ending. The charms of youth are at their greatest at the time of its passing. It is the final glass which pleases the inveterate drinker, the one that sets the crowning touch on his intoxication and sends him off into oblivion. Every pleasure defers till its last, its greatest delights. The time of life which offers the greatest delights is the age that sees the downward movement, not the steep decline already begun. And in my opinion, even the age that stands on the brink has pleasures of its own, or else the very fact of not experiencing the want of any pleasures takes its place. How nice it is to have outworn one's desires and left them behind. And Seneca goes on and talks much about old age and watching himself age, and then he concludes, "But I must close this letter now. What, you will be saying, is it coming to me just as it is without any parting contribution? Don't worry, it's bringing you something. Why did I call it something, though? It's a great deal. For what could be more splendid than the following saying which I'm entrusting to this letter of mine to you? To live under constraint is misfortune, but there is no constraint to live under constraint. Of course not, when on every side there are plenty of short and easy roads to freedom there for the taking. Let us thank God that no one can be held a prisoner for life. The very constraints can be trampled under a foot." It was Epicurus who said that, you protest. What business have you got with someone else's property? Whatever is true is my property. I shall persist in inflicting Epicurus on you in order to bring it home to the people who take an oath of allegiance to someone and never afterwards consider what is being said, but only who said it, that the things of the greatest merit are common property.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts, discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
So in Stoicism, as in Christianity, the four, you know, the core four virtues, the cardinal virtues, courage, justice, wisdom, temperance. Sometimes courage is rendered as fortitude. And so I love this. I love this word. I love that you built your book around it. To you, are courage and fortitude the same thing, or is one subordinate to the other? Can you have one with the other? What's the relationship to courage and fortitude?
Oh, I'm sure there's a relationship. I mean, it's not a question I've given a whole lot of thought to until right this minute. So I guess I can stumble through it.
Pull it out of your ass.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, of course they're related. I mean, I guess I would define courage as the ability to confront what makes you uncomfortable and to confront hardship, and fortitude is more defined as resilience through adversity. Of course, they're related, but they are different, I think.
Yeah, I think the Stoics would probably say sort of courage includes fortitude. You can't be courageous without fortitude. So certainly you could, I guess, be sort of tough and resilient in an uncourageous way as well, sort of around the wrong thing. But if we take fortitude as this core virtue, this thing that we need, I'm curious, how do we cultivate it? Because I agree that it's lacking, you know, sort of, I don't think it's a political statement to say that we live in a time sort of devoid both of courage and of fortitude. How do we cultivate that then, whether it's in young people or in ourselves?
Well, the first step is to read my book, Fortitude,
sure,
the instruction manual on how to cultivate it. And so we start the book with a couple lessons that I think are in order for a reason. You could probably change up the order slightly, but for the most part, I think you need a sense of perspective on what's actually hard and what isn't, and what suffering really is and what it isn't. And then you need to identify that you even want to have fortitude. So you have to want it. You have to envision it in your own attributes. And so, like, you know, the first chapter is called Perspective from Darkness. And I walk through what my perspective was in literal darkness and, you know, being blinded by an IED. And then, but a bit of perspective that's associated with that, and thinking of others who have gone through it and had it worse, and others who have paid the ultimate price. And you have to live with a certain truth about your hardship and suffering in this life, which is somebody else has gone through worse and they probably handled it better than you did. And you should feel, be kind of ashamed of that. That feels like a very callous, tough love comment, but it's true. It is a guaranteed truth. And it's also possibly true that you've lived through something harder before. And you should think back on that. And remind yourself of the scars that you bear and how you can overcome this too. And so perspective is just really important, and it takes a level-headed person to have it. But you have to want all these things. And so the second chapter is called Who is Your Hero? And it's a chapter about developing this sort of like vision board for yourself about heroic attributes and about identifying what is truly a heroic attribute and what isn't, and how our society has just totally screwed that up. We believe that heroes are victims, basically. And instead of looking up to Superman as a person who makes the right judgments and shows courage in the face of adversity, we would prefer that he's a victim who has been victimized in some way. And then we could elevate him to this heroic status. And that's a crazy thing. And it's created a fragile society, but it's also created a very angry society that would prefer to follow a fist shaking activist trying to tear it all down, as opposed to somebody who talks optimistically and courageously about overcoming adversity and talks about the future.
Yeah, I think what you talk about in the book that I think ties into both those things, both perspective and your sort of hero, is this idea of a narrative. Sort of, what is the narrative that you're following? What's the narrative that you view history from? How do you look at, you know, the story of America? Is it a story of, as we're being told now, it's a story that sort of was stamped from the beginning with white supremacy? Or is it you look at it as a story of sort of unrealized hope and optimism and principle that we've been inching closer to? You know, so that perspective, how, you know, do you see the glass as half full or half empty? Do you see it as, you know, irredeemably evil, or as not realizing its full potential? Sort of how you decide to view the world, the story you tell yourself about the world and your place in that world, determines what choices you're going to be able to make in response to things.
Yeah, you know, personal narratives matter. And in the book, I go into the personal narratives and the stories you tell yourself in overcoming your own hardship and the statements you have to make. And then I broaden that out to talk about the story of America, as you mentioned. And, you know, it's not even about being optimistic. It's about being objective with respect to the story of America, especially. We've sort of allowed this narrative to be spun that the American founding is based in some evil, and that you're watching it play out. Everything I talked about in the book, you're watching play out right now, in extreme form. And we always knew that eventually they'd come for the founding, and the 1619 Project is an example of that. Tearing down statues of Washington and Jefferson are examples of that. You know, it's no longer just some Confederate statues, which you know, you can make a much more reasonable argument about, but it's about the union now, basically. And that's a crazy thing. And again, it's much more than just a different perspective. It's more of a false telling of history, and it's extremely dangerous. And it comes from the victimhood culture that we've lived in for a while now. And so the victimhood culture, it hurts you personally, for sure. I mean, it feels good at first because it allows you to blame somebody else for your own circumstances. So it's a bit of a warm blanket to wrap yourself in. But objectively speaking, it has no benefit for you. It is fundamentally a look at the past as opposed to the future and what you can do. And so there's simple little mantras that I think you can tell yourself, which is you know, what I point out in the book is, you know, there's I have to statements or I get to statements. And I like this little trick. And it is a trick because it's you know, here's what I mean by it. Like, do I have to wear an eye patch? Do I have to wear these big thick glasses, or do I get to wear an eye patch? Because I can find some kind of silver lining. Do I have to go find a new job because I lost my last one? Or do I get to explore new opportunities? Now, to a certain extent, like this is a mind game, right? Like there isn't some great thing about losing your job, right? I don't know, pretend there is, but there's certainly no benefit in wallowing in self-pity, objectively speaking. And there is benefit in this sort of, you know, false optimism, even if it is false, it doesn't matter. It's objectively good. And so telling a correct story about self-empowerment is an objectively good thing, even if you were truly victimized. And of course, outrage culture, you know, the victimhood culture is more about perceived injustices that aren't even true. And that's been a wildly popular narrative for a while. It doesn't mean there are no injustices that are true. Of course there are. But the way you deal with those doesn't really change.
I think it's, and what the Stoics would say is sort of, is the story that you're choosing to tell yourself about this thing, is it giving you more agency or less agency? And so I think the opposite of victim culture is sort of high agency culture, right? Or a victim narrative versus an agency narrative. I mean, if you look at the civil rights movement, or you look at the leaders who have brought about great change in this country and in the world, what they're almost always doing is focusing on a narrative of agency. Like, I think that, you know, you look at a Frederick Douglass or you look at a Martin Luther King, what they focused on, they didn't, they're sort of unflinching in their assessment of what is wrong and who is to blame and the severity of it. But what they're doing is looking at how this contradicts the promise of the country or what is objectively and sort of inalienably sort of right. And then they're focusing on how do we get closer towards realizing that vision, as opposed to, as you said, sort of let's tear this all down because it sucks and it's broken and it's hypocritical or what have you.
Right, right. And that's why, I mean, I write about Frederick Douglass's speech in the book in the last chapter, where it is a good example of becoming part of the American story. And that was Frederick Douglass's message. He was pointing out the hypocrisy of the times compared to the founding, because the founding was inherently abolitionist, and any objective scholar agrees on that. It was there is no other interpretation of history. There just isn't. And it's just a fundamental lie that keeps getting told by institutions like the New York Times and the 1619 Project that our founding was based in slavery. Our founding occurred in the midst of a worldwide epidemic of slavery that had long been an institution. So to say that it's a uniquely American sin is just historically an absurd claim. It is Western civilization that ridded itself of slavery, and painfully so, but did it. And America did it within a century of its founding. And to tear apart that history is really strange and unfortunate. Because what Frederick Douglass said was that these are glorious liberty documents, and that we should live up to them. And that if we're going to write these things like we rightfully did, then maybe we should live up to those things. And society has to catch up to the theme of America, to the founding of America. And society eventually did, but it is society and it takes time. And he was one of the fighters for that. We've turned that narrative on its head now. And it's deeply unfortunate. And there's only chaos that it leads to. We're already seeing it. This is something I always said before, but it was always like, well, I don't see any chaos. So, you know, I don't know, Dan, you're just making this up. But clearly that's now not true. And it's just a really sad time in America, because it happened much quicker than I thought it would.
Well, and I think this is why these virtues are related, right? So this is why Christianity and Stoicism both, you know, obviously courage and fortitude is a virtue, but so is wisdom, right? And to, you can't have wisdom without courage, because it, you know, truths are hard and uncomfortable. You also can't have wisdom without courage to face those facts. But I think what you're talking about is you have to actually understand what those documents are. You have to have the sort of mental rigor to sort of go to the original text, to understand them, to mess around with the uncomfortableness of history and the truth of it to figure this out. And I think we now live in this sort of tweet or soundbite culture where, you know, someone can say, oh, I read in the New York Times in the 1619 Project or whatever, this, and then that becomes true. What I think people are lacking is a sort of a basic sense of civics or a basic sense of or knowledge of history that allows them to sort of wrestle with this stuff and also not be so easily manipulated by, you know, sort of claims by activists and extremists on both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, and it's been happening for a long time. I mean, you know, if the 1619 Project was the only thing, then it wouldn't be as persuasive to people. But these narratives of anti-Americanism have been around since the 60s, really, when sort of a Marxist ideology kind of came to be in the new left movements of the 60s. And it's been with us ever since. And as they've slowly seeped into academia and pop culture, where it's become more and more popularized to believe that America is a scourge on the earth. And sure. it was easy to do that in the Vietnam era. And it's been that sentiment has been applied to more and more aspects of American life, to where there's this sort of self-loathing that occurs. And, now it's still not the majority, but it's clearly growing, and this from the statistics would tell you that, and surveys would tell you that, and it's very problematic, and it is based on a objectively wrong view of history, the Howard Zinn history, and you know we have wisdom is a virtue, and people are not really willing to thoughtfully engage in it, unfortunately. There is more of a call to emotion. And again, this kind of gets to some of the themes in my book where you, again, back to the heroic attributes theme, you want to be somebody who is wise, not somebody who is emotional. There is no virtue in emotional reactions, even though that's been elevated as a virtue in our current culture. And it's dangerous. It's very dangerous.
And I've talked about this before, but I'd be curious for your take. This idea of heroes, which is actually one of my favorite chapters in the book, it's something I've written about before. I think when you really look at the history, the Confederate monuments, it becomes more and more indefensible. Not just because what did the actual documents of the secession plan for the states sort of explicitly, why were they rebelling, so on and so forth, which is almost secondary to when and why did these monuments go up, and what was the intention of the people putting them up. I feel like that position becomes more and more indefensible. And if I was a black person, I would be rubbed quite the wrong way by the idea that, you know, the courthouse that I have to walk into is adorned with a statue, you know, in honor of the people who enslaved my people. And by the way, that this was put up and funded with my tax dollars over the last, you know, 100 years, which I was forced to pay while being illegally deprived of my right to vote. Right. So I think that position becomes somewhat indefensible. But what I think is interesting, to go to your point about heroes, who do we worship? It's interesting to me that we don't have a good answer as a society as to who should we put up there. Right. And so I'd be curious, like, when you think about heroes, when you think about this idea of fortitude as a American and a cultural value, who should we be holding up as like the embodiment of what is good and what we should be teaching our children to strive to be like?
I mean, there's a huge variety of options there. Again, it's easier to look at who we shouldn't,
sure,
as opposed to who we should. There's a million reasons why you erect a monument, and there's usually something that person has done that has contributed to society. It's usually what it is. It's not, you're not erecting a monument because you think they're a god and you think they're Jesus Christ and perfect.
Sure.
That this is what people forget. It's totally reasonable, as you stated, to be having a debate about Confederate generals being erected as you know, and idolized in a way. That's a perfectly reasonable debate to be had. It should be had in a democratic process and not in mob form, because nothing should happen in mob form. But
right.
That's quite different than tearing down at the founders. You say, of course, but like a lot of people disagree with that now, and they've been radicalized to such a huge extent. And that line has to be very clearly drawn. I mean, it just has to be very, very clearly drawn. And the question does have to be asked, why was it put up? That, like you said, that is a good question to ask. Was it put up to sort of stick it to the North? I mean, and if so, does that mean are you defending a deeply evil ideology? And if so, then that is a good reason to want to remove it and replace it with something else. But it has to be done democratically and objectively. It's not a unreasonable conversation to be having by any means. But it's
no, I just mean I'm not asking you to sort of say who should America put up on you know, if we replace all these monuments, who should they be? I guess I'm just curious, like, sort of, who are your heroes in this regard? Like, who I'm just like, if someone was like, hey, I want to learn more about, you know, somebody that embodies these ideas, who is the best of us? You know, to me, like, I think it's interesting. We got a lot of statues of Robert E. Lee, but very few statues of, say, a George Marshall, right? You know, like, who does embody the best that we should, you know, think about? Like, who are your heroes, I guess, is what I'm saying.
I mean, you know, and even in the book, like, I don't list my heroes. I don't have heroes.
I noticed that, yeah.
Yeah, because I've never been into biographies. I've never thought about it that way. I think heroes are important, but not in the way that people normally think of heroes. Like, who do you look up to? And like, who's your favorite general and who's your favorite president? I just don't think that way. It's not how my mind works. I'm also, you know, I don't, and I decline to ever answer it because I'm like, well, I don't know enough about all of them, frankly. You know, I'm not a student of all of them. And I just, so I just find the, I find the premise of the question to be it's not well suited for me and how I view history. What I talk about in the book are attributes. There are virtues, and some people embody those in a decent way, and some people don't. You don't need to wrap your head around one person. In fact, it's unhealthy because everybody's got something about them that isn't so great. And that also opens you up to all the criticism. Oh, well, that's your hero. Well, didn't you know that they cheated on their wife? So you think it's okay to cheat on your wife? Now, it's a super disingenuous accusation, but it's what people do because they're jerks. And I'm not saying I do it to protect myself against jerks. It's just not how I think, I guess. Like, I don't have that historical mind. I have a conceptual mind. So I'll draw upon little tidbits of history to back up the concepts that I think are long and deeply held and tried and true over time. And I think that's just a healthier way to think about it. Because I can never come up with a bunch of people that I think are heroic and that should be erected in statue form. I'm sure. Asked often, like, who your favorite this is, who your favorite that is, and I just don't have it. And I don't even like, and even if I am thinking of something, I just don't want to say it because I don't want to be pinned down to it, you know?
It's interesting to hear you say that as a very biographical person that just always sort of, I guess I was always looking for models and sort of advice and structure and, you know, things. Seneca says, you know, sort of without a ruler, you can't make crooked straight. And so he talks about picking a Cato, you know, so for Seneca, Cato is his hero. But I wondered then if maybe that explains your sort of love of fiction. I kept seeing you mention the sort of novels that you would read in the book, a lot of sort of historical fiction or sort of military fiction, where, you know, if you were describing them, what you'd say is, although the people and the events aren't real, the ideas and the traits are real. And so maybe that's sort of where you've been getting some of your guidance, if not from the biography of this man or this woman.
Well, yeah, and I do, I did talk about that in the, because what I'm talking about are heroic archetypes. And that's the term they use. And that's a maybe a psychological term. But archetypes are a better way to talk about this for the reasons I've stated. Real people have real flaws. And so it's better not to idolize them. Except for Jesus. Jesus is the only real person that has no flaws. And so that's an important tenet of Christianity. You're never able to become him, but you at least know what to strive for. And fiction, what fiction gives us is kind of those perfect person stories as well, like Superman, because it's fiction. So there isn't going to be some like bombshell that comes out about them. And so a better way to teach people how to live is through storytelling and through narrative. And it's why Jesus talked in parables. Because Jesus didn't really look to past figures either. He always spoke in parables as well. And I think it's the right way to teach, and it's the right way to think about who you want to be. And so the answer to who is your hero, because that's the name of the chapter, who is your hero? The answer is you. Right. You're supposed to be your hero. It's the vision that you build for yourself.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so let's talk about outrage here, because obviously that's a theme in the book. And I think I was talking to Shaka Smart, who's the head coach at UT this morning about this. He had sent something to all his players about sort of, being offended by things and how you manage that. And we were talking, one of my favorite quotes is from Epictetus. He says, when you find yourself offended, understand that you are complicit in taking the offense, essentially that it takes two to tango, which sort of reminds me of something you talk about in the book, which is a great quote. I forget who it's from, but it's worth repeating. You said, try not to offend, but try harder not to be offended.
Right.
That is a statement of human agency, right? That you have the ability to choose not to be provoked, I think is really interesting and not discussed enough these days.
Yeah. I would have put that quote in my book if I'd heard it until now. It's a great quote from, because I talk about, I can't pronounce his dang name,
Epictetus.
Yeah, Epictetus. But he's in my book. I do talk about him. I don't really talk about him. I reference Admiral Stockdale, who was a student of his and talked. What you're really saying in that quote is hyper accountability. And that's what, you control what you control, and you don't control what you don't control, and you have a hyper rational view of what that is. And the reality that the problem most people have is they believe more things are out of their control than are really out of their control. And so, yeah, being offended is your choice, 100%. Just like getting coronavirus is your choice. It's always strikes me as insane that we're even talking about lockdowns at all anymore. I think it's a totally debunked idea at this point, because all along you could choose not to get it. You can choose to lock yourself down. It doesn't mean you can lock other people down. There's a huge degree of power that we have over our own lives that we just consistently refuse to admit. And so that lack of accountability leads to outrage culture, because if you're offended, you choose to be offended. You're letting somebody else control your emotions. And that quote, by the way, that I put in the book about, try hard not to offend others, but try harder not to be offended. That came from a Harvard professor, and he said that to the class in orientation. And it always stuck with me, because it was just so spot on for a college campus. And it's just the right balance that our country needs so badly right now. Don't be a jerk. Don't try to trigger others. And this is what the right needs to learn too, because the left is always triggered, but the right, we love to trigger them. That's not necessary. There's a way to trigger them with truth, and because I trigger them too, but I'm doing it with, I think, objective facts and truth. And there's a way to do that without just pissing people off. But being offended is 100% within your control. And
I agree. And look, I think this sort of it's interesting how this sort of snowflake culture begins on the left on college campuses. And it's a real problem. It's really something it shuts down ideas. It shuts down debate. It prevents people from learning, as we talked about. But it's been interesting to me as someone who sort of identifies as center right, but is not a fan of the president and sort of talks about these things from a historical sense. I'll sort of criticize things. It's interesting to me when you see how easily triggered people are, even on the right, about you know, the inability to, like, if I really liked a writer and then I found out that they had different political views than me and they happened to mention this in something they said, I could not imagine so losing my mind that I would have to send this person a really angry email. So what is it culturally where we've just lost the ability to understand that other people's beliefs are their beliefs and that they don't have to have any impact on your beliefs? You don't have, that doesn't have to upset you. And if you disagree, you can just talk to that person about that thing. Yeah, I don't understand that. It's so...
Or agree to disagree, right? And it's like...
Yeah.
I mean, because yeah, the right gets triggered, but yeah, in very different ways than the left does. And it's unhealthy, but it's not quite as unhealthy as the left-wing sort of microaggression triggering culture that they have. They're much more... It's much more detrimental on their side, but it's not like, and I talk about this in the book too, it's not like the right doesn't have its flaws and inability to think through, you know, being a politician, like I call those types rhino hunters. They're always looking for a rhino, and meaning a Republican in name only. And so they're always looking for someone who's betrayed them. There's sort of a deep paranoia there. So the left is always very quick to try and force conformity, force a thought process, force a certain narrative. They really want to change others' nature and their thoughts and beliefs. And they want to force them to do it, and they'll cancel and shout you down to whatever extent they can. The right's a bit more paranoid of betrayal. And so they're always looking for someone who's betrayed them. And as opposed to engaging in classical liberal values, which are just conservative values at this point, of free thought, discussion, and debate. And what I say is it is the sign of a mentally weak person that gets mad instead of formulating the argument to just debunk whatever they disagree with. You know, and like you have to, and again, that needs to be part of your hero archetype. Am I the type of person who just spouts off? Or am I the type of person who spouts off but also lists a lot of good reasons and facts as to why I disagree with them? And, you know, because that's healthy. It's healthy to disagree. It's just the way you disagree. I think that's not, you know, because I don't blame anybody for sending an email to a writer that they used to like, but then had an opinion they don't like. It's just the way you do it. You know, is it, right. And there's a big difference in just kind of activist fist shaking versus and just calling somebody, oh, you're not a real Republican if you don't believe this, or you're not a real this if you don't believe it. You know, seek to understand. And that requires a degree of mental toughness.
I would also say, and this is what was striking to me in your interview with Bill Maher, and then also your reaction to Pete Davidson, that I think is interesting, and maybe it's a place to wrap up, but it is a thing that's also to me sort of severely lacking. The only other place I saw it sort of particularly well done was in that sort of famous Jordan Peterson interview. I think it was with the CBC, where even though the other person on the other side is hostile, even if that person's being critical, even if you're at, you know, complete opposite polar ends of the spectrum in terms of what you believe, what I thought was so interesting about your Bill Maher interview was just your calmness under that pressure. I'm sure that comes from your military training, but it, you know, it's sort of, you know, nothing compared to what you've been through. But I struggle with that myself. How do you, when attacked, when criticized, when dealing with a confrontation, how does one maintain that kind of coolness under pressure? To me, that is also a key, you know, sort of element of fortitude, is grace under pressure.
Yeah, and I have a whole chapter about that. It's called Be Still. And it's stillness in the Stoic sense, but it's also... It's stillness in the classical sense of like your mom taught you to count to 10 before you react, you know? So these are tried and true virtues, and they've long been a part of our culture, but we have to remind ourselves of them constantly. And so what I like to point out is none of these ideas that I talk about in the book are new, which is kind of why they're good. Now I frame them in new ways and I'm kind of re-exploring them, but I don't think anything is new, and that's made obvious because every time I have a lesson in there, I back it up with a lot of historical anecdotes. You know, I use the Stoic philosophy to back it up, and it's thousands of years old, so there must be something to it. Sure. I use biblical foundations too, and you know, there's a lot to back these basic ideas up. But stillness is really, and it is military training. I talk about how we train that way in the SEALs so that so that when you do come under fire, your immediate reaction isn't emotional. It's you just kind of train yourself. And this is done through wargaming, really. Like, you're just constantly thinking of what could happen. And so when it does happen, it's not this big surprise that causes an emotional reaction. It's just something you expected. In the case, and I talk about combative interviews too, where you can't just like throw your hands up and call the person names because you're mad at them. I mean, you can, but you're not going to look good, and you're certainly not going to win that way. So it takes practice, and people can practice this in their daily lives too. Like with, you know, because most people's confrontations happen on social media, and that's a great way to practice this. You're just not hitting send,
right?
You know, and thinking about, wait a second, what are the counterarguments to what I just said? Maybe I can just send a message that basically eliminates all counterarguments if I just put some more thought into it first. And I'm not saying don't argue online, go for it, but do it thoughtfully and using your head and not your heart all the time. Because you'll feel better afterwards for sure. Because how many times do you have an emotional reaction and then the next day you're like, I really wish I'd said that instead? Well, learn from that moment and war game it in your head and imagine those moments going forward, and you'll be better off for it.
Yeah, I feel like I've never been glad that I lost my temper. And I generally find anger to be a poor strategy. And no, it's funny that you bring up stillness. My last book is called Stillness is the Key. And it's about the sort of overlap between Stoic philosophy and Buddhist philosophy about that idea. We tend to think stillness is the absence of doing anything. Actually, to me, it's the sort of active taking of one's agency and deciding, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to respond. I'm not going to be jerked around. And I'm going to sort of focus on what's in front of me. And obviously, yeah, under fire, you have to have that, because if you are jerked around by your emotions, you're going to put yourself or other people in harm's way.
Yeah, and that's the point. It's an active decision, which is, again, why I start the book with Who is Your Hero? Because that's the chapter that tells you have to decide that you're going to abide by all these lessons. And if you don't decide that, then you'll never abide by these lessons. So it's an active decision, and that takes work, and it takes some self-discipline.
Yeah, I think we're on the same page. I think, unfortunately, we are in the minority these days as far as, you know, as you mentioned, the prevailing view is if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. If you're not angry, you're part of the problem, mm-hmm. you know, I do agree there's outrageous things happening. I think it's just hard for people to understand that being angry is not how you solve problems. In fact, it's usually blinding you to the solution. So if you do think that what's happening is evil, or you do think that what's happening is wrong, or you do disagree with the president or this or that, or, you know, police brutality, if you want to solve that, what you need is stillness and calmness and those heroic archetypes, because they're really complex problems and you're not going to solve them emotionally and irrationally and passionately in the ancient sense of the word passions.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why I start the book talking about the intro is about staying outraged. And,
yes.
And the sort of slogan that you referred to of, stay outraged. And there's like shirts made and buttons made, stay outraged. And you're like, you're actually perpetuating the totally wrong philosophy. That's in no way, shape or form is that how Martin Luther King made vast changes. You know, it's completely the opposite of his philosophy. And he was successful. And there's a reason for that. The reality is with the current cultural narratives of stay outraged, things will get worse before they get better. And we just have to start teaching the right things.
No, that's great. Congressman, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Ryan. Really appreciate it.
If you're liking this podcast, we would love for you to subscribe. Please leave us a review on iTunes or any of your favorite podcast listening apps. It really helps. And tell a friend. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Guy Raz's How I Built This is a podcast where each week he talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you hear these entrepreneurs really go into their story. And Guy is an incredible interviewer. He doesn't just dance around the surface. He has real questions because he himself is an entrepreneur. He's built this huge show and this huge company. In a recent episode, they talked to the founder of Liquid Death, that crazy water company that's become this billion-dollar brand. Follow the show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And for a deep dive in daily business content, listen to Wondery V. Destination for Business podcasts with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.